So hello and welcome to another Future Pharmacist Conference session. Dead excited about this one. Really important conversation coming up. We're going to talk about a few things. So we're going to talk about, the title of the session is Advanced Practice the Answer to All Our Problems in Pharmacy? And on the line, we've got VIP Scottish pharmacists here tonight. So we've got Jackie Snedden, we've got Susan Roberts, Fiona Mara, Paul Forsyth, and Gordon Rushworth. And I'm gonna just leave it to you guys to maybe do it, starting with you, Jackie, maybe to do a round robin and just introduce yourselves, and we'll take it from there.
Hi everyone. So my name's Jackie Snedden. I'm an antimicrobial pharmacist and I work for Healthcare Improvement Scotland, which is one of our national NHS organisations. And my role there is to lead the Scottish Antimicrobial Prescribing Group, which coordinates the National Antimicrobial Stewardship Programme. And I've been in this particular role for the last 13 years.
Hi everyone, I'm Susan Roberts. I am one of the Associate Postgraduate Pharmacy Deans and I have within my portfolio at NES both pharmacist postgraduate education and all of the pharmacy technician and pharmacy support worker education. I've been involved in the process around about consultant pharmacist. I was involved with Gordon in the development of the curricula by Royal Pharmaceutical Society, and then I've also been involved in the advanced practice curricula with RPS as well. And it's my job within NES to support the service to introduce advanced practice and consultant practice into Scotland. And just really quickly, why is it so important to me? It's so important to me. I think the future of pharmacy depends on us doing this successfully and bringing in advanced practice and consultant practice. And I think it's something that the pharmacists out there have been waiting for a long time.
I'm going to go to Fiona in a minute, but we're going to come back to that. We're going to talk about what the difference is between consultant pharmacists and advanced practice, because I think that's important. Fiona, you're next.
Hello, everybody. So I'm Fiona Mara. I'm based in Glasgow and I work in HIV and hepatitis, bloodborne virus, hepatology. So I credentialised in infectious disease and hepatology. I'm split posted between adult and paediatric, so I currently work as a national lead clinician for paediatric infection, and I cover an adult role as well in bloodborne virus, and I also work for the University of Liverpool in clinical pharmacology. I'm just completing a PhD with them, and as a kind of little offshoot, I'm working with Public Health Scotland at the moment just on a secondment, so that's just kind of short time. So a couple of different part-time posts knitted together to, I guess, build my portfolio in the area that I work in. So thanks for having me.
Fantastic. Yeah, thanks, Fiona. Paul, you're next.
Thanks, Johnny. And again, thanks for the invite to speak and come together tonight. So my name's Paul Forsyth. I'm a cardiology pharmacist, again, from Glasgow, like Fiona. My job involves outpatients, primary care. I dabble a little bit in helping community pharmacy with cardiac related things as well. So I kind of sit with a foot in two or three different sectors of care. Why is advanced and consultant pharmacy important? For lots of reasons that I suppose we'll talk about in the next hour. But I think what it will do is it will give some structure, some governance, some quality control, some hope for the next generation of pharmacists that are going to come along. And I'm really excited by helping all those guys achieve it, regardless of what sector of care that they work in. And that's what's getting me going over the next few years now is trying to help professions see that come to fruition. So thanks for the invite today.
Very good. Good to have you, Paul. And finally, last but not least, Gordon.
Thanks very much, Johnny. thanks for the opportunity to come along and talk to you tonight. So my name's Gordon Rushworth. I'm Programme Director for the Highland Pharmacy Education Research Centre based in Inverness up in NHS Highland. And I've got a portfolio post where I spend about 50% of my time in general practice and then the other part of my time doing education, training and research. So I'm education and training lead for the Highland and Island boards, and I've got a research portfolio as well, mainly which I undertake with University of the Highlands and Islands and RGU. I think really, you know, why is it so important, and why have I, you know, credentialed as a consultant pharmacist? I think for me it's got to be about, you know, clinical leadership. I think that's what I, or this is the way that I think that I can probably be of most use and most service to the profession within Scotland, is offering this kind of portfolio post and really making that count of taking back that my dispatches from the front line of delivering sort of clinical service, and then stitching into that the work that I'm doing with delivering sort of education and training reforms, and the kind of research portfolio that I do, and looking at really, I think for me it's got to be about what is it we need to do to change how we train pharmacists to make better pharmacist clinicians, and that's really the main driver for me to want to credential as a consultant pharmacist.
So thank you very much, everyone. It is like, for me personally, it's absolutely amazing to have you guys on the call. And you know, Scottish pharmacy has always been seen as maybe this is my bias, I don't know, but people say it leads the way, and we do feel, you know, I do feel we're always one step ahead for various reasons, and I mean that across all sectors. But I'll tell you something, this feels different. This feels a bit different. It feels like, and hopefully you guys can come in and sort of explain, fill in the blanks of why it's different. But you know, there's a movement towards leadership, and it feels to me like you guys are really at the cutting edge of the reprofessionalization of the pharmacist profession. And I suppose, you know, with that grand setup, I wondered, maybe Susan, would you like to explain maybe what the consultant pharmacist credentialing process is? And I'll just sort of, you know, some sort of areas to cover, you know, what is the difference between consultant pharmacist credentialing, becoming a consultant pharmacist? What has the role got to do with it? Where does the employer fit? Where does the RPS fit? Is there room for other credentialing bodies and that kind of thing? And that's about six questions there. But
I know, yeah, you'll be here till midnight answering all. I'll be here till midnight talking about all that. So what is the process? So just to explain the process as best I can. So consultant pharmacists at the moment, we have the curricula. We only have one curriculum at the moment, which has been developed by the Royal Pharmaceutical Society. There's no other curriculum out there. Scotland at the moment haven't agreed. We don't have any Scottish Government policy for this yet. But why would we go and write our own curriculum when we have what we and some of us in Scotland have contributed to the RPS curriculum, and we feel it's as good as we've got right now, and it's certainly setting that standard right now for that patient-facing role. So we've got that standard. It's an RPS curriculum. So at the moment, to be credentialed as an individual, you would submit, gather your portfolio of evidence over a period of a few years. Now, the group we've got here are a wee bit different because they have all retrospectively completed their portfolios. So they had all the evidence gathered over many, many years and really just pulled it all together and put it into the portfolio and submitted for credentialing. But going forward, it'll be more something that's done as you go along. So as you are an advanced practice pharmacist, you will start to build your portfolio across the five domains. So the RPS have got five domains of practice. and you'll build that portfolio. And when you're ready, you'll have various professional coaches and mentors who will support you through it. You'll submit that portfolio. RPS have a panel, a competency panel, who decide whether or not, between them, whether or not you are meeting that level of practice. And it's important to notice that it's entry level consultants. So again, the four people we've got on this call today, I would say, are without a shadow of a doubt way above entry level consultant pharmacists. And we need to make very clear that going forward, that entry level will be different from what we see and hear from the four of our consultant pharmacists on the call at the moment, or the four who've credentialed as consultant pharmacists. And that probably brings me on to quite an important point. You can't call yourself a consultant pharmacist until you have a consultant pharmacist post. And so as an employer, whether it's NHS Greater Glasgow or NHS Highland or NHS Health Improvement Scotland or whoever, or community pharmacy or whoever, they would need to put a post through that credentialing process to give it that standardisation that it meets the requirements for a consultant pharmacist post. And that's why the process now is a little bit different than it was in England historically. And the feeling is we're kind of raising the standard of both the posts and the people on the standard, so that it is different than it has been from those posts many of us are aware of in England and Ireland and Wales. So that is the process. As I say, Scotland don't have policy for this yet. So we have a group set up. Ness are hosting some groups who are leading some of the educational reforms. And there is a group who is chaired by David Coulson, who are going to look at the governance around this and the structures and the processes to get it all agreed in Scotland going forward. So I'll stop there and take breath and see if you want to ask me anything, Jonathan.
I'm impressed. You did well. You did well. You've covered a lot of bases there. So, I mean, that's so useful because it sets the scene. Simple question for you, Paul. How many, and I'm picking on you, sorry. How many consultant pharmacists do you think Scotland needs?
I think that's still to be decided because most people don't understand what a consultant pharmacist is to begin with. And I think we need a strategy once we have a common understanding of what it is, of how many that we need. So I can try and explain, first of all, what I think a consultant pharmacist is versus advanced, and then I'll answer your question, Johnny, because it's hard for me to answer one without the other. So let's start with advanced. What is an advanced pharmacist? Well, an advanced pharmacist, from a clinical point of view, is somebody that will take a wee bit more responsibility for making autonomous decisions when they're uncertain or there's lack of evidence. And they can use their judgment to take all their skill, their knowledge and their learning and make that complicated grey decision in front of them. So that might be a community pharmacist looking in an ear and trying to see if you've got an ear infection. It might be me reading an ECG and deciding what I'm going to do with a medicine. So that's the kind of clinical part of being advanced. And to go with that, you're going to have other roles and responsibilities about your team and your service. So training juniors, making sure your service is effective and it's doing what you want it to do, researching that a little bit, leading elements of your team and the staff body around you. So that's advanced. And that probably is where most career grades will be. Somebody that's very good at their own work and taking a wee bit of responsibility for their team and their service, and a wee bit even into the organisation that they work for. That's advanced. What a consultant pharmacist is somebody that their scope is a wee bit higher than that. And what do I mean by that? That I mean that they will be looking really at the big system that goes around their type of pharmacy, beyond their organisation, beyond their profession. Will negotiate with other bodies, with government, with big stakeholders, with professional bodies, with royal colleges. Will be caring about undergrad teaching, postgrad teaching, multi-professional teaching. Will be looking at services and how effective that they are. That's what a consultant is. So to maybe take my form of pharmacy as the example in cardiology, how many cardiac consultant pharmacists do you need in Scotland? I don't even think I can answer that question, but it's, does every board need one? No, because why would you need every board, every small board, having somebody negotiating with government about where pharmacy fit in a cardiac sense? you might need one or two. How many do you need for things that are very prevalent, like care of the elderly or mental health? Maybe more than that. Specialities like Fiona's, maybe one or two like mine. So what is the number? I don't know. But what these people will do is lead that kind of clinical element or speciality element beyond their organisation, beyond their profession. And why is that needed? Because we miss the boat with some of this just now, Johnny. So, you know, when I sometimes go to some of the national cardiac meetings, I'm the first pharmacist ever to go to them. They're like, oh, a pharmacist. Oh, great. We've never had a pharmacist on the group before. What can pharmacists do? I'm not sure. Can pharmacists treat cardiac patients? We've never heard that. So what we do is we break down some of those barriers and we try and get the pharmacy voice into big committees and decision-making structures. And we do that as somebody that's recognised by the rest of the peers at that table as being credible and reliable. And because of that, we can then influence policy, health ministers, et cetera, et cetera. That's what a consultant pharmacist will be. How many you need? I don't know. That's what we need to decide in Scotland, I suppose, over the next 5 or 10 years. And we need to have a strategy around it. So if we want them in community pharmacy and general practice and whatever, then we have to create the conditions in these roles to allow their formation and to support them and to support the people there to develop the skill set. So I'm sounding a wee bit like a politician. I can't answer your question, but I can. We now need to get together as a community and decide that over the next 5 or 10 years. And I'd argue that that's what Scotland have the opportunity for here. So rather than having all these historic ones that we don't know what to do with, let's decide what we want. Let's create the conditions for the ones that we want. Let's all work together to have that, to make that happen. You know, I think that's the exciting thing in Scotland. And I suppose I think me and this group are really keen to work with all of those stakeholders to see that vision through.
I think it's a fair enough vague. No, it wasn't a vague answer. It was a wee bit political, that answer, Paul. Not like, yeah, but it was like a how long is a piece of string question. So it was a bit of an unfair question. Susan and Fiona want to come in. Susan, you go first.
I just wanted to come in. I think that it's really when you talk about how many do we need, and I think it's really important. It's that need rather than want, because that some people might want to be consultant pharmacists and think their specialty deserves one because they have spent a lot of time doing lots of research and they've been doing it for a long, long, long time. But it must come down to population health needs. And so therefore there is an answer to this, Johnny. There is an answer, but we've not worked it out yet. So I don't think it's just a case of Scotland sitting down and going, oh, it'll be 10 or 20 or 100. I think we have got a blank piece of paper in Scotland and we're not in the position England's in, where we've got people who have been sitting in post for long periods of time. So, but I think there is an answer to this. There is a formula to work this out. And I think it's round about strategic population-based health need at the most strategic clinical level, which we don't have from our current pharmacy leadership structure. We don't have that clinical leadership voice at the highest levels in government, unless you're somebody like Paul, who's muscled his way into some of these cardiology government groups. There's not that, those openings aren't there for people. And Jackie's another good example, and so is Fiona, and so is Gordon. So all the people on the call are, and so is Andrew, who's not on the call, are all examples of operating at that level.
Yeah, just thinking about the number of posts, so, and reflecting what Susan said about there being lots of posts south of the border. So in England, there are many consultant pharmacist posts in my specialty of antimicrobials. And certainly about 5 years ago in Wales, they started to develop these posts, and they agreed on their model from the start. So they have somebody as the All Wales consultant pharmacist, which is very similar to the role that I have in Scotland. But then each of their 7 health regions have also got a consultant pharmacist in them as well, who will lead the local sort of stewardship programmes. And I think there are quite important differences between the posts as well. So the All Wales consultant is, like myself, not in a patient-facing role, but nonetheless does have a lot of engagement and and working at strategic level with government, with other national stakeholders and professional bodies, whereas the pharmacists within the regions will be hands-on dealing with patients, but will also have some sort of strategic role within their region to lead the service there and to deal with the local stakeholders, as well as input to the national programme. So I think it's not one size fits all, and you really have to look at the need of the specialty and the need of the population that that specialty is serving to decide how many pharmacists do we need. So, you know, in my particular area, it might be that the national role is the only one, or it might be that we say, well, actually, we would quite like to have maybe two or three other consultants for antimicrobials that cover the three sort of basic regions of Scotland to provide sort of strategic input to them. But that's still to be decided.
Thank you very much, Jackie. Fiona?
Yeah, sorry, I've regained my train of thought. I mean, I think I was talking about, you know, why we would want people to do this. And I think it's such an important new avenue into pharmacy, because it provides, I guess, for people like us that have been around a long while, but that have a real kind of clinical background to their core, that perhaps don't want to go into management or, you know, leadership roles entirely, but want to kind of hold on to their speciality, something really worth working towards. So I think, you know, for me, that was a kind of key area. And I guess, you know, whether it's a kind of 3-year or 5-year or a 10-year plan for someone as a career, as for pharmacy as a career, it's a great new avenue to aim for, because I think there's a real reputation that you can only go so far in pharmacy and then you have to start managing teams or, you know, kind of stepping back from your clinical role. So for me, that was the big kicker. That was why I kind of wanted to go for it. I was, you know, working outside my board. I was taking on projects, you know, out with the country. I was getting involved in research, but it was all, everything was core to, I guess, for me, being a hospital pharmacist or being having a kind of clinical speciality, and everything rolled on from that. So for me, I was able to look at career progression, still maintaining my speciality. And I think that's something that we've not been able to offer before in pharmacy. So for me, that's a really exciting time for people kind of coming through that actually think, I really love my area that I work in, and I don't want to get to that kind of AA stage and make a decision between plateauing at an AT and as a clinical specialist or progressing with my career but dropping it to go into management.
Very interesting answers, and very interesting conversation, and a conversation that I think probably needs to be amplified and heard far and wide. My mind always goes to sort of like a fatalistic view of our profession, and at the core, I'm sort of, you know, over the last few years through PIP, I've been thinking quite existentially, like what things like, what is a pharmacist? You know, I've been influenced by Zubin Austin's research, who you'll all be aware of, you know, the procrastinating perfectionist and all this. And you know, I was down in Birmingham at the show a while ago, the pharmacy show a few weeks ago, and there's still a lot of, And I hope folk who are listening don't take this the wrong way, there's a lot of painting by numbers in pharmacy. And the reason I'm so excited to, you know, to speak to you lot basically is because it feels like you've really moved beyond that. You're out in the grey area, and you know, you're credentialed, you're looking at your competencies, you're demonstrating your competencies, those have been checked and quality assured. So I suppose where I'm going with this is, what does that mean? And I'm going to bring you all back to reality, because this is all up in the clouds, you know, chat, a lot of it, and might not be that relevant to the coalface. But what do you think, like, your average, and no pharmacist is average, of course, but what do you, for the sake of conversation, what do you think your average community pharmacist locum or employee, doesn't have to be a locum, you know, average community pharmacist thinks when they see you guys speaking, and what's your message to them, I guess? Paul?
So what's my message to them? That we're all colleagues, and that any of these levels of practice, whether they're advanced or consultant, are achievable and relevant in any sector of care. So how can I possibly think that about community pharmacy? Because it exists just now, Johnny. We just need to modernise the way, how we call it, what we call it. So what is advanced? Well, in Scotland, we have the Common Clinical Conditions Service, which is Pharmacy First Plus now, where I can take my daughter along and get somebody to look in her ear and to tell whether she's got an ear infection. So they need to pull an otoscope out their pocket and look in, and maybe she's stuck a jelly bean in her ear, or maybe she's got an infection. And I want that person to be able to see whether they can visualise her eardrum and whether she's got a jelly bean in her ear, or whether she needs an otomized spray, or whether she needs nothing and some paracetamol. So we already have a contractual frame in Scotland where community pharmacists are going to have to start living in the grey and operating with new skills that they weren't taught necessarily at university. So some of these things we were, like over-the-counter stuff, some of these examination things were not. Those pharmacists also have always looked after a little team beside them. They've always educated their pre-reg and their new dispenser, their pharmacy technician. You know, they've always really looked at better ways to do things. This is not a big leap. Advanced is not a big leap at all for community pharmacists. We just need to modernise it, because the GPHC over a generation now will regulate this. So my advice to them is, you're almost there with advanced. Let's just modernise the governance around it. With consultant, I think there will be a little bit more head scratching. And I think, do we want them? Where do we want them? What would they look like? Because these guys are the kind of ones then that would help negotiate a contract for them, or go into negotiations with the BMA, or, you know, find out where they're going to fit, help plan a recovery from COVID. You know, so does every community pharmacist need to aspire to that level? No. Would everybody want to? No. But should we create the pathway where some of them can continue to be a community pharmacist one or two days of the week while doing all those big stakeholder things about making the contract and their terms and conditions and their services better? Absolutely. So these visions can all work as a community pharmacist. I'm a very belligerent person, Johnny. I think you've known me probably long enough now to know this. But the way I explain it to juniors, it's something called your locus of control. I strongly believe in my internal locus of control. And what that means is I can change my job. I can change my profession. I can make things better. I can make services better. I can make the profession better. If you think like that, you can make these visions work for you. If you have an external locus of control where you think somebody's stopping me, the man on the hill isn't going to allow me, then these things won't work for you. So where you can find people like us to help work with you and mentor you, where you believe in yourself and where the conditions allow it, then these things will absolutely work in community pharmacy. I'm convinced of that.
Brilliant. I'm going to come to Fiona in a minute. But I was just laughing there, because I remember being told off one time for prescribing automized because it was too expensive, but other ear products are available. Took me back. Anyway, so yeah, just to follow up, Paul, do you feel the inference from what you're saying there, and what I wasn't expecting to hear tonight, was do you feel that pharmacists control our own destiny at the moment, or are we being controlled by other people and other professions? And does that matter?
So I don't believe we are being controlled by other professions. I don't believe that we aren't in control either, but I think there's a significant proportion of our community that believe both those things to be true. And I think what we have to do as a generation is convince people that where we can have a common voice, a common understanding, a common respect for each other's roles and about what different stages of your career means, where we can offer population level care, population level benefit, that's where we can change your own destiny, get better services, better terms and conditions, better whatever. But I think there's not enough of us that believe that. And I suppose what my interest now is in the next generation is convincing them and showing people like Fiona and Gordon and Jackie and others that we can change the system, guys, but there's a way and there's a competence and there's a skill set that you need to learn. And that skill set's not just about you as an individual. So it's about working with others. It's about understanding the system. It's about understanding what we need, what we want. It's about understanding education and training others. You know, so where you just look at yourself, you won't get to these levels. But where you can work with others within our profession, and that's what we're terrible about, Johnny. I think pharmacy doesn't have this collective kind of community and identity. We're really fragmented, and I think that's what we need to change to see this vision through.
I'm labouring the point maybe a bit, but I totally agree. I think, you know, we're all colleagues, we're all on the same page. At the end of the day, we're all pharmacists. It's just finding that sort of like thread that holds us together. But I really liked your think about the locus of control. That's really interesting. Fiona?
I was just going back to the point about community pharmacy. I mean, I think what links us all is the five of us have had, you know, we probably haven't taken the normal path, whatever the normal path is, to get to where we are. And I started in hospital pharmacy, but then I lived in Africa for 5 years and I did development work over there that was nothing to do with pharmacy, came back and I locumed for a year in community pharmacy. And whilst I was doing that, decided I wanted to work in infectious disease, but, you know, didn't have a job. So whilst I was in community pharmacy, I self-funded a diploma. I did my independent prescribing. I worked in a kind of travel tropical medicine clinic, which I organised myself. And that was very much as a community pharmacist. And that then led me back into hospital and into infectious diseases. And so I think there's certainly lots of different avenues that can take, and perhaps, you know, because we have kind of jumped different pathways, and I've worked in one of my jobs at the moment was previously medical, that I think there's a lot about that, just kind of taking a kind of off the track path, and I think that's maybe what links a lot of our journeys together. But it's certainly not that, I think the message I'm trying to say is you know you don't have to be a hospital pharmacist from day one or a primary care pharmacist from day one. There's no kind of real mould for this. And I think the five of us have shown that from the public health, the primary care, the hospital, all the different areas that we come from. But community pharmacy can very much be part of that.
So what I'm hearing is it's not one of these things that's like, you know, sector specific or anything like that. And I suppose on that note, a good segue would be maybe to come to, without picking on you, Jackie, Andrew, you and Andrew are in non-patient facing roles. So I suppose a good, you know, an interesting question there is, would you say, or when you talk to the others in the group, would you say that your journey has been more difficult or just different because you're not in a patient facing situation?
I think it's probably just been different, and so although I'm not in a patient-facing role, a lot of the work I do is patient-focused, so it is influencing the care of populations of patients. So, you know, two of the key domains that you have to demonstrate your practice in is around clinical practice, and I do have a strong background in hospital clinical practice, and the other one is around communication, and that's communication both with clinical teams, but also with patients. So, you know, to demonstrate that where somebody in a patient-facing role could, document a conversation they had with a patient about who's maybe got complex needs in terms of their medication. So obviously I can't do that, but what I have done within various pieces of work I've been involved with is develop information for patients. I've worked with patients or patient representatives to develop the information that they would need for a particular condition. And so that sort of ticks that box in terms of the communication. So it's not with one patient, but it's information that is for a group of patients with a particular condition. So it's just about looking at things differently to demonstrate that you are competent at communicating, you know, at that level about complex issues with patients or with clinicians. And I think the other member of the five of us, Andrew, who's from public health, will have done similar things in terms of some of the work he's done around resources to support patients in, within public health.
Very interesting. Yeah, and Andrew couldn't make it, unfortunately, this evening. He sent his apologies. But yeah, I mean, we've covered work that a lot of you have done on PIP, but I mean, we covered Andrew and his hepatitis work, you know, his involvement in all that stuff. And I know from talking to him over the years, he's been involved in lots of really innovative projects as well. Gordon, I'm gonna come to you if that's all right. I look up to every one of you, but I really admire your career path, Gordon, because I think you've gone into primary care, you've gone into GP, and you've got a bit of research going on. You've got a bit of working towards advanced practice, because we now know what that is, not consultant pharmacist activity. So within that whole space, taking a step away from the whole consultant pharmacist thing, because I think we've covered that, where do you see the future of pharmacist education going? I'm asking this because I know you've got an interest in simulation and stuff like that. Like, what I'm particularly interested in around that is, like, do we need to just replicate the medical model and build infrastructure around that? Do we need stuff like this is my assumptions, but do we need things like supervision, a lot more reflective learning, multidisciplinary case-based learning stuff? How do you see that translating? And when you're thinking about it, maybe do think about all the sectors of pharmacy, you know?
Yeah, thanks very much, Johnny. I think you're right. As never before, the pharmacy profession, not just my own sector of practice, the pharmacy profession are being asked to do things which have traditionally been a medic's role, I guess. So even if you take it back to something which has been quite long standing, and you take it back to something like prescribing. So prescribing's been around for the entirety of my career. The entirety of it. So it wasn't me, obviously, when I first came in from my MPharm course, but there were people there who were on that first year able to prescribe. But prior to that, that was a medic's role. Now it's commonplace, and now in the next few years, we're talking about that being every pharmacist, every pharmacist graduate will have that level of skill. Well, I guess if I pick prescribing, actually, because there's a commonality with that across all the different sectors. The problem that we've seen with that has been that because we're pharmacists and because we're coming at it from a pharmacy background, we're really just focused on the medicines. There was quite a lot of resistance. I took quite a lot of resistance, quite a lot of flack in my career when I qualified as an IP a decade ago, because I realised that actually, to be able to prescribe and to be able to do that competently and safely, I needed to actually extend my skill set beyond just putting pen to paper and prescribing. Paul articulated earlier that advanced practice is really about dealing with those shades of grey, being able to put pen to paper where there's you've gone beyond the evidence base or the guidelines that are available. To be able to do that safely, we need to be able to practice in a different way. So coming back to your point, Johnny, that you're asking about, do we need to look at different ways of training and teaching? Absolutely. Completely. We need to think about the end product that we are wanting to produce, which is essentially a pharmacist clinician of some description, and take that from actually what will be foundation pharmacist with an IP qualification, and move that up and find out what that's going to look like at advanced. Consultant's a bit of a different beast altogether. That's more about kind of business transformation, and Paul gave a great overview about what that would look like. The actual career grade endpoint for most pharmacists, I suspect, in a generation, is is probably going to be advanced and at that advanced level. To be able to deliver that, you're saying in jest, do we need to just copy the medics? I think to a certain extent we need to adapt the plethora of research that's been done in medical education, but we need to adapt it for what we're going to be doing and the slightly different role that we're going to have. But now, I guess, if we've been asked to do something which a medic was asked to do 10, 15 years ago, then yeah, actually we should be training the same way. So absolutely, in terms of something like, we need to have a framework, we need to have a curricula, and these new curricula that are coming out from the RPS, or that certainly from my specialty, the one that has been available through NES for general practice clinical pharmacists, has been relying on supervised learning events. You cannot pass it unless somebody clinically supervises, unless somebody observes you in clinical practice and gives you feedback on your knowledge, skills and behaviours. That's absolutely essential. So to even up to consultant level, all of us had to complete that. I think things like that, there are techniques that you can use to augment any given training pathway. Things like simulation based education. Yes, that is a very powerful tool, and I'm working with a pharmacist up in Orkney called Lindsay Steele, who's researching this topic right now. Also, things like, we need to look at how much clinical exposure we give our pharmacists and our pharmacy students in training. And at the moment, it's just frankly not enough. We need to keep that going and keep pushing that forward, giving them clinical exposure, giving them supervision, giving them feedback, changing the culture, of how we support pharmacists, support people to adapt and take on that clinician mantle. Things like training with others, interprofessional education, that should just become part of the mainstay. That there's such commonality, and we need to kind of dampen down this protectionism that we've got of, oh, I couldn't possibly do your role, you couldn't possibly do mine. Quite a lot of it's actually quite similar. So why don't we train together? And Highland, actually, we've just had a paper accepted today, earlier on today, which is a Scottish Government pilot in which we performed a pharmacy longitudinal clerkship. And over a course of 3 years, we had three different cohorts where we took final year MPharm students from RGU, and we put them into general practice, and we put them in for prolonged periods of time. So the first year was 11-week periods. We embedded them in that general practice setting. We taught them how to consult with patients. We taught them how to use, otoscopes and sphygs and how to undertake basic observations and some basic examination skills. And we gave them that clinical supervision. And do you know what happened at the end? They had a better time. They felt more confident. They felt more enthused about their profession. That is what we need to do. We need to think about how we're going to extrapolate that forward.
So fantastic answer. Like, I could talk to all of you all day about this. You know, I feel strongly about it, and I think we're all moving in the same direction. It feels like it's like an evolution. It's a progressive agenda that we're speaking about. I think a lot of those things you said are really interesting, Gordon. I was at the pharmacy show, and I was talking to, just by way of balance, I'm not dragging everything back to community pharmacy, but I'm trying to, I want to mention community pharmacy because I'm conscious that everyone on the call is NHS based. And one of the things, I'm not going to ask you a question about this, but it's because it's not fair. You're not working in that scene. But one of the questions I posed to the superintendents forum of AIM was, how do you build business models around what you've just described, Gordon, because, you know, at the end of the day, the majority of people still work, you know, pharmacists still work in community pharmacy. So if we're wanting to activate them and realize the potential of all these interactions of these millions of people that access them on a daily basis, then we've, just my opinion, and I welcome discussion on it if you want, but I think we need to crack that. Gordon.
You know, I can come in and talk about, even if we just take it back to the pharmacy longitudinal clerkship. So some of the students actually were working with us middle of the week in a general practice setting. But actually at the weekends, like many pharmacy students did, like I did when I was a pharmacy student, I worked in a community pharmacy. The difference in that student reported in her, you know, confidence in undertaking counter consultations, or even more, probably more advanced style of consultations, obviously under clinical supervision within the community pharmacy for things like urinary tract infection. She was getting to the point where that was very, you know, like a straightforward consultation for her, because she'd done it in different sectors. She'd also sort of seen what happens when you go beyond what was in the PGD for a urinary tract infection. She saw what actually needed to be seen within general practice and how that was managed as well. So this is almost like back to what you were talking about earlier, Johnny, about learning from the medical models and the medical models of teaching. So if you were going to train a GP, for example, they would spend time in the hospital, they would spend time in psychiatry, they would spend time in A&E, they would spend time in medicine, surgery, or whatever, as part of their composite of training. That's what we need to do in terms of our experiential learning. We need to expose our students to real life practice so they can apply the theoretical knowledge that they've got, and then understand actually the vital and critical role that community pharmacy can play in that, and actually how to plug in to these other systems, how to work more effectively with hospital pharmacists around admission and discharge to hospital, work more effectively with GPs for either acute common clinical presentations or more long-term conditions as well.
Mm-hmm. Very interesting. I suppose I'm always trying to be, you know, balanced and fair to everyone. I think in the interest of fairness, it's important to say around the whole experiential learning agenda, I think, you know, NESS, CPS, RPS to a certain degree in Scotland have all, you know, contributed to that direction of travel. Obviously, I think, feel free to jump in, obviously we'd all like more of it, but that will hopefully come. Paul?
Yeah, but just to pick up your point about how to make a business, or how to make, you know, an industry out of this, how to monetize it almost. That question's here, it doesn't matter which sector of care you work in, because if you work in the NHS, we have a finite budget that we need to spend somehow. If you work in community pharmacy, you are a business, you need to make a profit. So, you know, any sector of care, we have a responsibility to a budget. But the budget that we have is the budget that we have. There are other budgets out there that we miss. And why do we miss them? We miss them because, are we really solving population level health problems that appeal to the bigger machine of healthcare? I'm not sure we are, or if we are, I don't think we're evidencing it well enough. And where you have advanced practice people that are trained en masse well enough through Gordon's system, then I think we can start solving population level things, you know, making blood pressure better, eradicating hepatitis, putting smoking rates down. We suffer from death by vignette in pharmacy. You know, here's one like mad example of something that somebody once found that was brilliant. Well, great, but can you turn that into a profession for me? No. So until we can start appealing to the big machine, our budget will be our budget, and we'll be damned in any sector of care by it, and we'll miss the other budgets that fly past our nose. So we have to appeal to what the healthcare service need, and then as a profession, we need to solve it as a profession and evidence that we do. And then the next time they have a population-based healthcare need, they might think about pharmacy and give more funding into us. Until we can do that as a profession and as a community, we will struggle with this. So the trick is to train the people and then show the population effect of it on actual measurables rather than death by vignette. I'm really grumpy about this when I go to conferences and hear artifact cases about polypharmacy. No thanks. Show me what your staff body changed.
This is what I think consultant pharmacists could actually help with. Because you've got that link to actual practice, and yes, you know, if I think about it personally, much of what I've done is actually just try to figure out kind of pharmacists actually do these clinical roles as a kind of an N of one. And now it's actually up to, you know, this kind of bunch of people to figure out actually, well, okay, it does work in that individual, but how can you roll that out? What can be adapted to the masses such that we actually change the culture and we change the you know, the knowledge, skills and behaviours of our workforce.
It's so interesting. You've been very generous with your time, everyone. So I will. I've got one final question in a minute, but that is so fascinating, Paul. I like when you get upset. Like you know, more of us need to, you know, get grumpy. You know, go for it. Like, let's have a fight. Come on.
You have to use your frustration to make things better. That's my key driver of why I want to continue to help pharmacy and to modernise it, because I'm frustrated by it. I'm not frustrated by the individual, never the individual. I'm frustrated by the system. And I think that's now, as a generation, what we need to reject the old system and design a better one where we fit in a modern healthcare system and that the system produces, you know, a defined benefit for the population.
And that is the most optimistic notion, in my opinion, of what a profession is, because we're on the register. We're in a privileged position to be allowed to work together to collectively do that. And that's why, you know, speaking to you lot is so exciting, because you are right at the front of that. Just before I ask my final question, Paul and Gordon, a lot of what you were speaking about there resonated with me as someone who's in business. You know, like, there's nothing more soul destroying than solving problems, you know, solving really important problems, according to me, that no one cares about. You know, that is not profitable and just exhausting and it's just not sustainable. So a word that I know it's not, it's bandied in the NHS a bit, but a word that I would quite like to see a little bit more of in pharmacy is entrepreneurship, maybe clinical entrepreneurship. But by the same token, I take your point about like pilotitis and, oh yeah, this is a great idea, look at me kind of thing. So I guess there is a balance. But again, speaking to Gordon's point, maybe that's like totally what the consultant pharmacist group could offer. And that's a really helpful concept to understand the whole point of a consultant pharmacist role, to be honest. You know, it's like I see it as a leader, isn't it? It's a leader and a gatekeeper and a custodian of where we're all going, really. And speaking about where we're all going, we do have a new chief pharmaceutical officer, Professor Alison Strath, who's also been very kind and agreed to speak at our first ever conference, which, by the way, must be face-to-face next time. This is lovely speaking to you, but honestly, it would be so much nicer to see everyone face-to-face. And then we could have that fight in person, Paul. That'd be magic, wouldn't it? We could shout at each other. But anyway, to finish, and you know, I say thank you to everyone before I ask this, but I suppose around Robin again, if I don't want to put anybody on the spot, but around Robin, maybe around, where do you think, or what would you like Alison to hear? What does she need to hear? Silence.
I'll start off. I think Alison needs to hear, and I think she knows this, that to give this some traction, so that we can move it forward, we need Scottish Government policy. And so she needs to hear that loud and clear, that this could be the topic of this discussion was, is advanced practice the answer to all our problems? And the answer is yes, but not on its own. It needs all that infrastructure. It needs that thought. It needs that thought about how it applies across all different sectors. And that's where we need Scottish Government policy to help us with this. And I think she understands the benefit of these positions. We perhaps need to make that clearer to her so that she really sees the benefit of having strong advanced practice and strong, eventually, consultant pharmacists in Scotland, and what we would see from a health care point of view coming out of that, the other side. But I think she just needs to hear, we need to just get on with this and get this into policy.
Brilliant. Thanks for going first. I think the pause at the start there indicated how much respect everybody's got for our new chief pharmaceutical officer. But and actually, maybe I should have asked something like, you know, what problems can we, I don't want to change the question, but what maybe if I was doing it again, I would ask maybe what problems could we solve that Alison really about, you know? But anyway, what does she need to hear, Paul?
So similar to Susan, we do need policy here, so I won't reiterate that point. But what does she need to hear? There's a whole generation of pharmacists now that want to start living in the grey, that want as a community to be more effective, that want as a community to fit in a modern healthcare structure, that want to be valued, that want to be effective. And we now need the conditions and the policy that allows that this won't happen without the policy and the cultural conditions around it. Gordon and I wrote a concept opinion piece on this about a month ago. The future is right there to grasp, but there's some policy and culture that's now needed to support it. And the culture is the training and the competence, Johnny. So what are these portfolios that we're banging on about? Well, it's the modern way of assessing that you are capable of doing the new thing, the new scary thing that I'm asking you to do. Okay, so that's the culture that we need to change. We need to normalise that. But if we don't have policy that normalises it, then will the big chaotic body of 5,000 pharmacists in Scotland, will we be able to move it forward without like a big shiny cloche coming off a policy? I'm not sure, but there is this generational change that's needed around that competence and training that Gordon spoke about, and there's a whole generation of pharmacists now that want it. I'm not saying it's 100%, but I think the majority of pharmacists in the current generation now can see that future and just need support to get there. The policy is the thing that will help us.
Excellent. Gordon, you had your hand up next.
Yeah, so I'm going to say something which I'm sure Susan and Paul were already chuckling away. So I mean, I'd be very keen to come and talk to Alison about what I'm calling advanced pharmacist practitioners. This is essentially a space within the clinical sphere of practice where I think pharmacists could retain all their kind of expert medicines knowledge operating into the shades of grey, and then they could layer on top of that and compound into that a more structured training program to give them advanced clinical assessment skills. And actually I could see a place for these in every sector of practice. There's a handful of people right now in the country, I'm talking maybe 20 people, who have undertaken these the kinds of university level advanced clinical assessment modules. And actually I'm undertaking a piece of research just now funded by NES with RGU, and we're talking to pharmacists who've been in these, and and the research isn't quite completed yet, but certainly the comments that we're getting back are all around the same kind of thing. We need to galvanize ourselves around an opinion of what these individuals could be, and have a think about actually how could we employ them, and how could we create a training program at scale to deliver something which I think within the realm of advanced practice or advanced non-medical practice, probably only a pharmacist could actually deliver. So I'd be keen to sit down with her and have a coffee and chat about that.
Well, I think you've just signed yourself up for next year's conference, and that could be session number one. You and Alison having a wee blether. I'm sure she'd be up for it. I was going to say though, I listened to a really interesting podcast a while ago and it was an interview with the lady that started Starling Bank. I'm not sure if you're aware of this bank, but it's an online bank, and they basically revolutionized, or their idea was to revolutionize the user experience. But anyway, that's sort of by the way. This woman's whole ethos was around execute the idea. Most people have an idea and they never execute. She just executes all the time. And sometimes she fails, but the odd time she wins and she moves forward. And I think if I could pay you a compliment, Gordon, I think what you've done, what in my experience in my career, the vast majority of folk don't do, you've executed. And actually, more than that, you're painting a picture of how you could make it easy for other people to do that as well. So I just think you're on the right, personally think you're on the right track. Folk might disagree. I don't care. Keep going. Jackie.
Yeah, I think, my message to Alison would be, yes, you know, we need the policy. I think once we have the policy, that will allow us to create the structures within pharmacy. It'll allow us to develop the leaders of the future that we require. Some of us are older than others, and certainly one of my motivations for this was really around succession planning, so that the other people will be in a position to come into roles like mine to take on that national leadership. And I think the consultant pharmacist portfolio is what we need for these type of roles, because you do need such a broad range of skills covering, you know, everything from the clinical practice through to the research element. So I think that's what we need to progress the profession across Scotland.
Very good. And thank you very much. Very interesting. Last but no means least, Fiona.
Thank you. So, I mean, I think I would say that once the policy is in place, it's, you know, it's exciting to see what the future looks like with regards to advanced pharmacists particularly, because they're going to be bigger numbers. So I guess enabling people to have the opportunity to work within all the different domains. And I think for a lot of middle to senior grade pharmacists, that's a big block, and that's really difficult to perhaps just work out your clinical speciality. So to actually embed into their job description that, you know, we want you to do research, we need you to do research, you know, we want you to get involved in education and training, you need leadership and management, because so many pharmacists have never had that opportunity. And I think to embed it into their normal working practice, I mean, when I think about, I guess, where I've got to, one of those domains leads on to the next, which leads on to the next. So if I get invited to lecture somewhere or do some education and training, then that can lead to research opportunities, which can then lead to invitations to take on other clinics or, you know, work in other areas. And I think having that policy in place to say that, you know, pharmacists, you know, need to work in all these areas, and we can create time and create opportunities to do that, then I think it's exciting to see what that will then look like in a few years' time with all these skills in place for new pharmacists.
Wonderful. And again, interesting what you're saying there. That, I mean, a lot of that resonates with me as a, I suppose I'm a business person now. So it's quite at times like an iterative, collaborative, networking, tenacious, never give up type thing.
I think it's a common,
No, I was just going to say the fact that you just got to keep going, you know, and keep at it.
I think it's, you know, these things can be personality driven, and I've heard so many times that maybe people feel stuck in one area, and I think that this, it, you know, enables them, these frameworks enable them to dip their toes in other areas and see where that leads. So, you know, you've never done research before. Well, now we're saying, you know, to become an advanced practice pharmacist, you know, you need to have done some level with that. So as opposed to people that have perhaps been in post for a very, very long time and it's never been part of their job, so it's never been anything they've had to do. So a real shake-up. I think it's going to be a real shake-up of what things can look like in the future.
Exciting. And Alison's, you know, we all know her. She's, you know, completely open-minded. I'm very, very interested to go and have a chat with her as part of this conference as well. And yeah, I think the future's bright in Scotland. Look, you've been very generous with your time.
I was going to say something quite bold just before we finish, if I ever got the chance to say to Alison. I actually think if they don't make this policy, if we don't see this in policy, and we don't see the conditions created to allow pharmacists to practice in these different domains at these levels that we've described tonight, there's a reason for that. And the reason is it's the best thing for patients. We've got the skills to better healthcare. And I actually think if we don't put it in policy, the procrastinating perfectionists you talk about, I think we're going to become extinct. I think our profession will become, there'll start to not be a place for the procrastinating perfectionist anymore. We need to move into the grey. We need to be clinical leaders. And I would be so bold. I went to university with Alison, so I would be quite bold enough probably to tell her that if I get a chance over a glass of wine one night. But I actually think it's almost like we're at a tipping point. And if we don't do this, I think we're losing pharmacists to medicine hand over fist. They're all going, actually, why would I do this? I'm going to go into medicine or whatever. Or some of them are just getting in their yachts and sailing off over the horizon. I think this is a tipping point for us as a profession, and we just need to grab it. And we've got somebody like Alison, who's our CPO, who is innovative and forward thinking. So hopefully she'll listen to us.
But I think we've got to the, like, you know, the exist, for what it's worth, I totally agree with you. And I think people need to worry about that. You know, I don't want to finish on a negative, but then there needs to be like an urgency about that. And that is why I talk about these things a lot. You know, Zubin's research and all the rest of it. And you know, for years, some sectors have made a tidy living by doing, I'm going to say something controversial now, the majority of that role, you could argue, some would argue, is a technical role. And I think personally, those days are gone. There might not quite be enough of a financial incentive to make a massive pivot, but that day's coming. I couldn't agree more, Susan. Great way to finish. Thank you very much. Yeah, thanks for your time, everyone. Great to have you at our first ever conference. And yeah, just dead excited and feel dead chuffed to be able to talk to you all and you know, finish on such a positive note. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, Johnny.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Johnny. Cheers.